Chapter 27. Eris's Beginning. It hasn't even been a day, and the party for the wedding is still in full swing. There are pockets of arguments, but nothing interesting has even happened yet when Ares corners her and says, "I know it was you." Hebe goes cold. She wants to deny it, to lie and worm her way out of it. But if he already knows, then there's no point. She can't do damage control by pretending the damage isn't there. "Have you told anyone?" He raises an eyebrow. "And ruin all your hard work?" He sounds sarcastic, but like he's serious too. She just stares at him, waiting. "No, I haven't told anyone."
"Are you going to?"
"I should," he snaps. "This is dangerous and stupid. There are better ways to get power. There are easier ways. You don't need to do this."
She grins, because he's not going to stand against her. He's going to glare and lecture. He might even nurse a grudge. But he's not going to tell.
She doesn't need his approval, only his silence. "I don't want power to be given to me. I want to take it." She hesitates, because she doesn't mean this in a hurtful sort of way, but says it anyway.
"Father declared you the god of war, and so that's what you became. Hephaestus made himself from nothing, made things from nothing for the mortals, and so that's what they named him. The mortals declared him to be a god of crafting, and so that's what he became. But I don't want to depend on father or mortals."
"If your power comes from neither the Pantheon nor the people, then where?" he asks. And thankfully, he doesn't seem hurt, only skeptical.
"From where the first gods got theirs," she answers. "They were granted nothing and took everything. I'm going to do the same."
He blinks, then smiles for the first time during this conversation. "Chaos bore the gods, so you will become a god of chaos."
It's not quite the same, the chaos that birthed the universe, and the chaos she's capable of claiming, are not one and the same. But they're linked, and she has plans to use that link to her advantage.
"Yes." Her brother frowns and rubs at his chin. His hair is loose and long around his hips, how he likes to keep it, but is rarely able to because it gets in his way during battle. His chiffon is silk, something else he likes but doesn't often get the opportunity to experience. "One golden apple and a couple of feuds aren't going to cut it. Not if you want it to last. A slow build is all well and good, and worked fine for Hephaestus. But that's not what you need. You need this to be a stone in a river. You need ripples, and large ones at that."
"A couple of feuding major goddesses are pretty big ripples," she points out.
"It's not a bad start," he agrees, and she's going to smack him. "But it can be bigger. It can be more. You can make it more, and you know that. Why aren't you doing it? Why aren't you pushing it further?"
She looks away from him and admits, "I don't want to cause you more trouble." He's talking about war. If she really wants to be the goddess of chaos, then a terrible war would be a wonderful beginning. But starting a war when her beloved brother is so hurt by them seems cruel, and she doesn't aspire to be the goddess of cruelty.
Ares grins, sharp and dangerous. He didn't want to be the god of war, but no one can deny he's good at it, that he's molded his unwanted power into something deadly and different, and entirely his own. "There will always be war, my dear sister. The humans simply don't know what to do if they're not spilling blood. Maybe they learned that from watching us. There will always be another war. I will always inevitably be summoned to the battlefield. One more terrible war won't change that."
"You really don't mind?" she asks, cautious. because she wants it so badly she can taste it. But she won't run roughshod over her brother just to get what she wants.
"What do you care?"
he asks.
But he's still fond. "You wish to claim the primordial power of chaos for yourself. Strike fast and strike hard. I'll take care of myself, whatever destruction you bring."
She throws herself at him, and he catches her easily, pressing a kiss against her cheek. He puts her back on her feet, then pushes her back into the party.
"Go. You have more work to do."
Hebe grabs a flute of nectar out of the hand of the closest nymph, who's outraged at the audacity, until he sees who's taken his drink, and then he only bows his head in submission. For now, they cower from her because she is the daughter of Hera and Zeus, because she is the sister of Ares and Hephaestus. But that won't last. Soon, they will cower from her because she'll have the power to unmake them all, and this is her beginning. "To the fairest," says the apple, and she left it ambiguous on purpose, because she wasn't sure how she was going to play it. An argument about beauty among goddesses is all well and good, but not something they'll wage war over. "Who could it be for?" she asks, eyes wide and innocent, the sad and simple daughter of Hera. "Is not death the great equalizer of men? Perhaps it's for Hades." Minor arguments of beauty have been brewing all evening, but at this everyone pauses and looks at the golden apple with renewed interest. "Clearly it's for me," Aphrodite proclaims, who hadn't cared for the apple when it was only a trophy to physical perfection. "For love comes to all, no matter the status and circumstances." Athena's eyes narrow. Hebe is never quite sure if the two goddesses loved or hated each other, and often it seemed as if they didn't know either. Oh, how can love be fair when it cuts so deeply? Perhaps it's in matters of intellect and warfare where true fairness lies, for all people can excel regardless of their history. Hephaestus usually sticks close to his wife, but at the moment he's nowhere to be found, which is strange because Hebe had seen him earlier. But what it means is there's no one to restrain Aphrodite when she steps into Athena's space and says softly, dangerously, "The pursuit of intellect belongs to the privileged and the lazy, while love strikes all equally." "Please don't fight," Hebe cries, stepping between them. "Let's settle this without discourse. Perhaps an outside party to decide who's the fairest between you? A mortal, since it's upon your fairness to the mortals that you each claim the prize."
"A fine idea, daughter."
Hera's voice rings like the tolling of a bell across the party, and all fall silent as their queen walks towards them. Hebe tenses, because if anyone besides Ares can see through her, it's her mother. But Hera barely glances at her, instead striding into the middle of their semicircle with her hair in complicated curls and piled high, a more intimidating crown than any gold or jewels she could wear.
"But truly, the fairest of us is I, for I am the goddess of family, and even those who have no intellect nor love to claim for their own have a family connected either by blood or by choice. Clearly, I am the fairest of the pantheon."
For a moment, Hebe fears this will be the end, and both Aphrodite and Athena will lower their eyes and acquiesce the title of fairest to their queen. But Hebe had not spent months calling magic from chaos and pressing it into molten gold for nothing. Without her influence, without the call for conflict her golden apple exudes, perhaps it would have been nothing. Perhaps it would have all amounted to nothing. Her golden apple refuses to be nothing. It tugs and pulls at them, its enticing strife demanding to be used. Aphrodite and Athena, the motherless daughters of Zeus, stand against Hera, queen of the gods. This is still small, still a not quite argument, but she knows what it will grow into. This is the beginning of a great war, one born and nurtured by her magic. It will be of chaos, and so shall she be of chaos. By the war's end, they will curse her name. Eris, Chaos Child, the child of nothing more than the elements themselves. Hebe will always love Hera, but Eris will have no origins. Chaos came before all else, and it has no mother. Hades is walking down the hall of his palace, and then, in the next moment, he is not. He's in a place that is not quite here nor there, nor really any other place either. There are only three beings who can move him in such a way, and he's looking at all of them. "Fates," he murmurs, inclining his head. "To what do I owe the pleasure?" "It has begun," Lachesis rasps, a woman in the prime of her life and empty eye sockets. "A primordial goddess will soon walk this earth once more." An equally blind little girl runs her hand down the air in front of her, and for the briefest moments, Hades sees a shining silver thread, one of the millions that the women are constantly weaving. "We could change it, alter the destiny. It would just be one little snip." "All things must come to an end," comes the creaky, barely there voice of the crone. The single violet eye the fates share between them in her face. Atropos glares at her counterparts, and he knows that they can tell, even though they don't have eyes. It was them that taught Charon to see without seeing so long ago, after all.
"So this girl is the beginning of the end. We are born, and we will die."
"Then we will be born again," the child adds. Clotho reminds him of Styx too often, and he must remember that though she may look like a child, she's not one. Not even the same way that Styx is no ordinary child. The fates play by a different set of rules.
"Perhaps I like this world. Perhaps I don't want to leave it just yet." "We have time," Hades says. And they all turn and look at him, swinging their bodies around in unison in a way he doesn't think he'll ever get used to seeing. "The beginning of the end may be here, but the end is still a far-off thing."
Atropos says, wry,
"To master time is not to be a master of all that works within it, Kronos."
Hades flinches. No one calls him that. Very few even know to call him that. It's been a long time since the primordial gods walked the earth. Long before Cronus and Rhea came together to make his current form.
"I know that."
"From chaos we were born, and into chaos we shall fade," Clotho says. "How long can you avoid your end, Father Time? How long until not even your time can save you?"
Hades almost smiles, but restrains himself. He doesn't think they'd appreciate it.
"Thank you for the warning, Fates. I'll keep my eye on the ticking clock."
On the clock he controls, of course. Their hands are moving through the air, touching strings he cannot see, and rearranging them faster than his eye can follow.
"Goodbye, King of Death, Father of Time."
Hades inclines his head, but doesn't bother to voice his own goodbye. Once they resume weaving, he knows they can no longer hear him. He returns to his castle under his own power, and goes in search of his wife. Persephone must be told first, after all. Hebe is not the first god to reach for the power of chaos, but maybe it is time for the beginning of the end. Maybe they should let her keep what she's so desperate to steal. Just because it nearly destroyed Dionysus doesn't mean it will destroy her.